Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Pulp Oscars. And today we are extremely excited to have Dr. Christine Jacob and Don Grant with us to talk about strategies for successful digital adoption in healthcare. Dr. Christine Jacob is a PhD in technology adoption in healthcare with over 20 years of industry experience. She's a researcher, digital strategist, and a lecturer. Don Grant is a director of the College of Dietitians of British Columbia and a leader in patient engagement and active patient partner in healthcare. Welcome, Christine and Dawn, to this podcast.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
We're extremely excited to have you here. And I'm joined with my amazing co-host, Dr. Maida. So I think we'll start the discussions with Christine and Dawn telling us a bit about yourself. Christine, why don't you go first?
Thank you so much for the kind introduction and for having us. Again, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm Christine, and I have a background in pharma. So I worked for some of the pharma giants, always working on digital strategies. And, you know, for years we started creating digital tools when we identified the strategic opportunity in the market, and we identified the potential, and we started creating good stuff. The technology was there, we knew the need is there, but adoption was not really picking up as much as we wanted to see it. And this is what drove my curiosity to move into academia. This is when I started my PhD and looking into adoption factors, because there were some theories back then, but I really wanted to understand what makes the user tick. And that's how I spent the last 8 years talking to clinicians and patients around the world to better understand what would make for a successful implementation and adoption, what would make them stick on the long run and really use a tool so we can see and really harness the potential and the promise of those new technologies. So in a nutshell, that's who I am.
Oh, that's amazing. Don, what about you?
Well, thanks. I have retired from a career with one of the big pharma companies, although I was in their diagnostics division. I've been retired now for 9 years, and I have found great satisfaction in nonprofit governance, and hence that's brought me to my role on the board of directors of a health regulatory college. And also I've got quite a keen interest in patient engagement in particularly healthcare research, and with an eye to like the ever evolving digital realm, because that's where it's at right now.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much, both of you, for your introduction. I think you're both of your, you know, you have your unique expertise in different areas, and it really sets the tone for the first question. So, you know, when we talk about research, we understand and we know that it's such a fundamental process in healthcare. You know, it contributes knowledge and informs actions for so many different processes in healthcare. But today we're living in an era that is guided by technology, innovation, digitization. So I wanted to ask you both, you know, what is the importance of ongoing research today to ensure the effectiveness and sustainability of healthcare technology? Chris, Don, anybody, if the floor is open, you can go first. Yeah.
Dr. Jacob, I think this is right up your alley.
Thank you so much. So thanks for the question. And I believe that research is very, very important and can play a huge role in advancing implementation and adoption of healthcare technologies. There are some challenges, though. Like, for instance, are we engaging all the right stakeholders? Are we engaging them in the right way? Are we asking the right questions? We see this in a lot of research that has been proven over years. We hear now about AI bias, basically, because we use samples that are not diverse enough. So I think it's not only about research per se, but it's about doing it right and engaging the right people, addressing the challenges that face sometimes patient engagement in e-health development, for instance, which goes beyond egos and lack of flexibility. So there's a lot of, you know, compliance and regulation challenges that need to be addressed. Things like, how do I pay a patient champion or a patient expert the right way? How do I engage them correctly? How do I ensure that the dialogue respects or deals with the power dynamic that unfortunately does not put the power in the patient's hands, right? I can see Don nodding, so I get my confirmation. So it's a lot of things to consider when doing research. One of the good things, I see it as a best practice here in InnoSuisse in Switzerland, for instance, which is the Swiss Innovation Agency, is that they design their grants always to pair a research partner with a practice partner, which is, in my view, fantastic. Because that ensures that we're not developing research in a vacuum. We're not just doing, you know, proper theories and doing it right on paper, but we're really informed by practice. We really see the challenges that are happening on the ground. We're walking hand in hand and trying to solve practical solutions. So I hope this addresses your question, at least from my side. Don, I'm sure you have a lot to add to this.
Well, that's interesting. And I have been privileged to sit on some of these, I guess, advisory panels. And I sometimes, as the patient partner, I'm the only one at the table that isn't getting paid. And not that it particularly bothers me because it's a choice, but it does kind of skew the demographic on who participates in this sort of thing. If only people who have the privilege, like I do, of having some financial wherewithal that I can take time from, you know, like 9 a.m. till 11 a.m. to participate in a thing when most people are out there turning the wheels of commerce.
No, absolutely. No, absolutely. And it is very important, as Christine, I think what you said was that we shouldn't be doing research in a vacuum and then, you know, say that the research results are not applicable or the research is not being adopted, or why are we not seeing changes in real life settings when there is so much evidence-based research on it? It's because we kind of put them in two different boxes and we never really make them come together. And I think it's so important that these two talk to each other, not after the research, but during the research. And that brings me to another question, which I think we all talk about a lot and we're very passionate about, is how important it is to incorporate health technology into medical education, research, and training in today's digital world. Christine, you can go ahead.
It's tremendously important because the research about health tech adoption from the clinician perspective shows that we have a clear need for more embedded technical training in medical education. And it goes beyond just adding, the technical skills or literacy to the curriculum. It really needs to embed technical solutions into the protocols and into standard of care. It also needs to look into, the helicopter view, like the overall view of how does it impact the workflows and the roles and responsibilities in a way that equip those new professionals with all the knowledge they need to get the stuff done. Because sometimes we focus on technology, we fall in love with what technology can do, and we forget to address the real pain points from a workflow process perspective, for instance. So quite often in my discussions with healthcare professionals, especially the nurses, because in many cases, they are the ones that deal with the data, you know, and deal with the legwork on the ground. And quite often they find themselves in the unfamiliar situation where they have to play roles they haven't been trained to do. So it's not resistance because they don't want to, or because they're just not innovative, or they don't want to adopt new technologies. That's not it. Sometimes they're just, from one side, not equipped with the knowledge and skills to deal with those new types of data and those new roles that they are being put in. And in some other cases, it's also the lack of workflow adjustment in a way that supports that shift. Mm-hmm. So as much as it creates a lot of efficiency, quite often it's a lot of extra load on the people doing it on the ground, right? So if you're bringing a new solution and you're bringing that much efficiency, you're able to address many more patients in the same amount of time, you have to also think about what it means from a workload perspective. I've heard nurses telling me, well, I can't have my coffee break anymore because now I have to deal with a dashboard to see if, you know, if I have to look if someone's having the severe reaction to the drug, for instance, or I have to stay after work because otherwise it's not going to be done. So as we bring those new technologies, we need to take into account those bigger pictures and to adjust the from one side, the medical education and the programs, but also prepare those new professionals to those new tasks that did not used to be part of the portfolio, because we're seeing new roles being created. I mean, we're seeing a shift now with more people with medical informatics background, for instance, which pairs medical education with IT, which wasn't a thing 10 years ago. But now we're seeing this, which is great. But we're not still seeing a nurse data manager, for instance, or, you know, someone who specializes in dealing with highly complex analytics and dashboards, not having to do this on top of everything else that they have to do during the day because they're super stretched. And we're just adding to their workload without consideration of what that means in their overall day. So I think from my perspective, it's education, but also preparing them for that new setup with new roles that go beyond the understanding of the clinical education per se, but also managing all this myriad of data sets that are being created and what that means and how do we efficiently use them to optimize care.
True.
Wow. Do you know if there's a checklist for this sort of thing? And the other thing I'll throw in there, Christine, is do you know if there's any jurisdictions globally that are that you can see that are doing this well yet?
I think it's still far from mature. It's still, I mean, there are a lot of efforts still. But even with the new programs, the new educational programs that we see start to become the new norm in at least some of the big medical schools, it's still far from mature. So if you look at a medical AI educational program that trains clinicians on AI code and brings them on board, and you just look worldwide, maybe there are three or four programs that you can find that address such a complex topic. And we still are facing the situation where we have to have those multidisciplinary team, because it's still, you cannot have the clinician be able to understand all those stuff because it was not part of their education and their background. But the clinician of the future needs to understand code and needs to understand data management and analytics, because you can't just have, you know, to embed those multidisciplinary team in everything you do. You really need to embed this as part of their integral education, because that's becoming the new normal in 10, 15 years. That's just going to become, if a clinician doesn't know how to deal with analytics and with code, I imagine, at least in some specialties like radiology, you'll find far less of those specialists having a job if they cannot understand AI and work with AI. So it will be the doctors who can deal with those quite complex and sophisticated skills that would be able to then survive. In my view, I think technology and especially AI is here to make us smarter, not to compete with us, not to take our jobs if we
absolutely it, right? No, absolutely. And, you know, just to on top of education, Don and Christine, it's so important that you said that we need nurses that don't do this on top of what they do. And I think that's a very important discussion, that we talk about AI and technology taking over the jobs. It's not, it's creating more roles. Mm-hmm. And Don, you were asking if there are any if there are organizations that are doing it. So I was recently in a digital health conference here in London, and the NHS is offering fellowships on AI and radiology, data analytics to clinicians, but not to other staff. And that's where I think we need to really look at, that maybe it's not the clinician's job. Why don't we create more jobs and teaching the admin staff on data security, teaching somebody else, the nurse, the allied health professionals, so that we can create more roles and give more skills to people who are not a clinician. That's fine, but they can really help a clinician with data security, with data analytics. Consent is so important. I think we talk about this electronic data. We don't know much about consent, whose data it is. So I think we can extend that beyond nurses and doctors and create more roles to supplement and create these multidisciplinary team for the future.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Go ahead, Don. Do you have any thoughts?
I'm interested in yours, Maida.
I think we're having a lot of people are having conversations about innovation, and especially in the medical education sector. And I know, a lot of my connections are very enthusiastic, and they're, making strides in VR and using XR and all of these, complicated and complex hardwares and softwares, and they're just ready to implement it. But I think some of the pain points that Christine mentioned, like, do we have the potential for newer roles? Are people ready to accept newer roles? Do we have that sort of stakeholder collaboration? And when we talk about stakeholders, we often forget the people in the middle. So yes, there's a clinician, and yes, there's a patient, but there's so many more people in the middle, and they're just sort of left out of the conversation. And then, of course, the clinical workflow, processes and efficiencies. But Dawn, something I know that, you're passionate about is when we talk about implementation and adoption, we often talk about early adopters and how they're not only leading the way, but laying the foundation for more advanced innovations. But on the flip side, you have your slow adopters as well. And we know as an industry, healthcare has sort of been slow compared to other industries. But in your opinion, and I'm going to ask Dawn first, and then Christine, you're welcome to share your thoughts. Will late adopters slow the broader digital adoption?
Yeah, I think that they tend to, and I think it's misplaced. People that take a long time to adopt a technology and celebrate the fact that maybe they don't even have a cell phone or they don't know how to do online banking. I'm just grateful that, for example, my financial institution hasn't waited for them to come on board. I think that we have to kind of adopt that. I heard the 80-10 rule, where you've got, 10% that'll never do it, then you've got 80% that'll do it, and then you got the 10% that'll do it exceptionally well. But we have to just march right along, because there's always going to be the late adopters. And I sure hope we don't wait for that lowest common denominator. And I think that suggesting that seniors as a demographic are resistant to technological change, perhaps I'm just running with a different crowd, but I just don't see that.
No, thank you for providing the perspective. I think that is a misconception, actually, that we're saying, people of sort of the older generation or the boomers, they are resistant. Even the physician cohort, they're resistant to change. But I think they're very open to change. I think they're very flexible. They've been very adaptive thus far. Christine, what about you?
I completely agree with you, Dawn, and I don't think it's necessarily a generational thing. And we've seen this in research. It's been inconclusive whether senior age would be a facilitator or a barrier. And when you look deeper and you really dig deeper and see below the surface, you will see that it's mostly other factors that come to play other than the age. So it could be that it's just that they don't have a support system that can help them manage this, or they don't see the utility, because many of those tools are more focused on the value of the data, the clinical data that it creates, rather than how does it fit into the patient journey, into their overall day and in their other pains. Yeah. And that in those cases, adoption become and stickiness become really challenging because they don't necessarily see the value for them. Even though it creates data, it helps the clinician maybe adopt the dose and the treatment pathway. But for me as a patient, what does it mean in my daily life? Does it give me advice? Does it address my other pain points? And so that's from the patient perspective. From the clinician perspective, there's a huge organizational aspect as well. Things like infrastructure, the data liability, the workflows and processes, the roles and responsibilities. And it's really, I keep trying to remind the stakeholders that digital health is not like other technologies, which addresses an individual user's need. It's a very interdependent and complex solution that has multi facets that addresses different stakeholders, sometimes in different institutions. And we really need to look at that complexity because the individual factors like resistance to change is one thing and it's very real, but it's not the only real. And what we have seen is that if you create utility that is beyond doubt helping the users either get their job done in a better way for clinicians or live their life in a better way for the patients, you certainly will achieve the adoption. So we've seen in several research examples where senior patients preferred the digital solutions when offered the right training and when things were made as easy and accessible as possible. I'm completely in agreement and in alignment with what you've been saying. It's not the demographics as much as the underlying factors that we really need to understand and deal with.
Yeah, I think that's where we talk about the patient's voice or the user's voice, both the healthcare professionals and patients, which seem to have been missing from a lot of these technologies that we see out there. I mean, if you really want people to, if they're trained well and they see value in what you have developed, you would not face a lot of resistance. Yes, there will be always some pockets that will resist it. And not because they just want to resist. I think it's just because lack of understanding. But we really need to have this participatory approach where the doctors have a voice, the patients have a voice, that what is it in it for them? What is the value that it brings to them? And what will they gain out of it? So I agree with both of you. So my next question would be, in your opinion, either one of you can go first. What are the challenges and opportunities of implementing technology-based health education programs? And how can we ensure that these programs are effective and sustainable over time?
Dr. Jacob.
Thanks, Don. I think one of the challenges is probably infrastructure and readability of educational institute to bring those new programs on board. So we've seen very successful VR and AR programs that have been used, especially in the COVID times, for instance, to avoid infection. So to train new doctors and new staff on things that they haven't used to do on their daily in their daily work, and to minimize infection and to bring them on board quickly. But of course, you really need to have the infrastructure, the technology, and to develop that content in a speedy manner to address that need. So I think from one side, the infrastructure and the readiness of those organizations, of those educational organizations, would play a role, and the flexibility into adapting and incorporating those new formats of learning in medical institutes as well.
I agree. And I think that there's a great role for private equity or private industry in this. And I think that to leave them out of, say, the halls of education or training hospitals, for example, or even family practice protocols, we lose a lot. So we need to establish some pretty playing rules or rules of the game, but not just invite but welcome industry partners that have like some really charming aspects to their to their product to come in and show us how to do it.
Yeah, no, I think what's lacking also is the incentivization of healthcare, right? Like you see all these cross industries, and I think that's sort of what you're going on as well, Dawn. And I think a lot of other industries, why they've been so successful in acquiring this sort of positive customer feedback is because they incentivize their customer journey. They lure, you know, they have the perfect hook, they lure their customer in, and then they are engaged with the customer throughout the journey. But I know, Dawn, that you live in British Columbia, and I know that something as simple as an e-prescription is not endorsed by the government. I'm wondering, in your experience, what has the pushback been, and why has there been a pushback in this?
Yeah, thanks for that. It is a bugbear for me because I just see that there's so many efficiencies that can be created by e-prescribing. We're like the patient's privacy is, I think, more protected because if it wasn't for, the clinical field of physicians and pharmacists, there probably wouldn't be a fax machine anymore these days. But I think that e-prescribing, there was a great opportunity during the pandemic to adopt it. And the government of my province, for some reason or other, held back. And I can only wonder why they held back. Part of it is, and this is just my musing, but the American Homeland Security Act requires that the government of the U.S. may have visibility of data for platform that is the digital platform is used sends the data to a U.S. I don't know server farm or something like this. So I would think that they want to be really sure that the data is staying within Canada, and that could be one of the roadblocks. But I really don't know what the other roadblocks are. But I do think that as long as the delay happens, unless there's some compelling reason for it. The patients suffer.
True. And I think these kind of things, lack of visibility, transparency, lack of trust in these systems is also one area where we see a lot of barriers, where people, patients and clinicians, I think both do have this issue. Where is my data going? Who can access this data? And that's why I always say that when you're teaching digital technology, always talk about data, always talk about security, trust, and consent, data ownership. I mean, there's so many things attached. As Christine, you said, it's so multifaceted. There's so many things, technology, and you know, telemedicine solutions and these mobile applications are just the surface. We can do so much more with the data these technologies are collecting on a daily basis, actually. So thank you so much. I mean, I think we can go on and on talking about this because you guys have such invaluable experience and insights to share. But thank you for joining us. And I will end on one last question to both of you. Maybe Christine, you can go first. So where do you think, what are you hopeful about in the coming years when it comes to technology adoption in healthcare?
I think one of the discussions that I had lately was about Walmart's expansion and it's just seeing this, you know, this new model that we have never seen before in healthcare. And in the discussions that I had with other experts in the field, it became clear that most likely if we see this pattern grow, the future of healthcare would become truly patient-centric, meaning that it's rather than being organized around processes and workflows, it will shift to the patient, where we have a true omni-channel approach that doesn't just add some channels, but really have a seamless integration between all the different channels and formats that allows the patient to be in the center and have the interactions with the doctor in the hospital when needed, in the grocery store if needed, you know, to just have the price transparency, the speed and the access, the geographic access with the pharmacy through things like e-prescription. So system solutions with maybe a remote physician or a remote care team, if possible, for mental health, for instance, that's super successful. So to really have care teams and services that really put the patient in the center and work together to offer better healthcare services to the patients. So as much as I'm cautious with things like data management and the consumerization of healthcare with those newcomers, as much as I try to stay optimistic into the type of customer centricity that they will bring, that is really far from real in the healthcare sector.
Thank you. What about you, Don?
Well, I couldn't have said it better or even come close. I guess one of the things I'm really looking forward to is being able to integrate stuff like the wearables, like my wristwatch, and being able to have that pay off in terms of dividends, in terms of my healthcare and my specific things. And I'm energized by things of like measurement of this or that that the watch will do. But I think that making it really consumer friendly and building on what we already have, I think it's a great huge wave, and it's coming over whether we're on it or not.
Absolutely. Thank you for sharing your thoughts once again and taking time out to join us on this podcast. Thank you to all our listeners. Please subscribe to our YouTube channel and like our LinkedIn page, where all our episodes will be live shortly.